the meaning of the fall. I'm hoping to speak to your condition this morning, as my Quaker friends would say. The fall has two clear meanings in our ordinary language. One of them is the season. It's fall everywhere but in Southern California, everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere except Southern California, where it's kind of high smog season, low smog season, earthquake season, but we don't do kind of the normal seasons. But that's one of the meanings of the fall. And the other, of course, is the theological idea that something bad happened in the Garden of Eden, and we've been really badly messed up by that. I want to talk about both of those ideas and concepts this morning, because I think that they are related, and if they're not related, they should be related. There are seasons in the world. There's spring, summer, fall, and winter. We can often appreciate those seasons, except, of course, in Southern California. We can appreciate what happens in the spring as the flowers bud, the fruit begins to take, as it grows in the summer, as the world warms and our hearts warm in the summer. And then the fall, as leaves turn to gold and brown and fall to the ground, and there's a certain beauty in that. And of course, the austere, classic Northern Hemisphere winter of white snow upon the ground. One of my favorite years of my life was a year that Helene and I took two major trips. One to Costa Rica, where we were in a riot of color and of nature. I'd never seen anything so wild and improbable as the colors, as the life forms, as plants that pretended to be insects in order to get fertilized, and insects that pretended to be plants. It was Halloween every moment in Costa Rica. And the same year, we took a cruise up to Alaska, and the stark beauty of the glaciers, of the white and the gray water, and still some green on the land. It was beautiful. All of our seasons have a kind of beauty, have their own snares and have their own gifts. The seasons are also metaphors for the seasons of our lives, of spring, of youth, of summer, of growth, of celebration, of play, of fall when it's time to kind of get down to work and have family, and winter as we age and as we feel and sense that darkness closing in on us. And it kind of gets our attention sometimes. But you know, the seasons are not actually as sequential as they may seem. I remember when I was very young, very young in the clergy, and I was reading a friend of mine's interview with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who did her work on the various stages of dying and talked about denial and anger and bargaining and acceptance. And a lot of people grabbed onto that as the roadmap. These are the stages that if you are normal and you are dying, you are going to go through. My observation was you could go through all four stages in an hour and a half and be back to denial. That we jump around through the various stages of life. And I think we jump around in the seasons of our life also, as we jump around in our own seasons. 2 weeks ago, or was it only a week ago, it was winter here. There was a cold storm before even the fall had set in. It was still summer. That doesn't happen in Southern California, but it does. There are glorious and warm days in winter, and there are cold and rainy days in summer. Time is not an arrow that proceeds directly and inevitably. It is an arrow, but it is more than that. We go back and forth in our various seasons. We know this about age. Age is very malleable, and I'm not just talking about people lying about their age. which I'm sure none of you have ever done. But I certainly lied about my age when I was young, wanting to be older. I may be reaching that point where I'm going to start lying and going back the other way. But age is not sequential completely either. It's relative. A teen actor or actress can be old at 20. A rock and roll act like Van Halen, touring in their mid-50s, is really old. An athlete may be old at 35 and a politician young at 40. The oldest I have ever been, and now that Danzig outed me, I'm going to be 63 on Friday with any luck at all. The oldest I have ever been was when I was in my mid-30s. I owned a home. I smoked a pipe. I drove a Volvo. And walking the dog would make me pant because I was old and out of shape. The youngest I have been in the last 5 decades was when Helene and I were bicycling on a tandem bike in Switzerland. Then I went biking with Frank, and I got old again because it's relative. We have days of youth and days of age, and they're not sequential. I warned Jack, but not Nancy, that they were going to be in the sermon today, because last week, having celebrated their 61st wedding anniversary, they were up on the dance floor at the Dobley Lillibridge wedding and dancing, unassisted by anything whatsoever except their friends smiling and beaming. All of us have days when we get up and we're old and tired and decrepit. And most of us can also look forward to days when we feel pretty good. Might not last long and we might pay for it the next day. Don't tell me. But it's still there. It is not completely sequential. But winter does come. The light does grow dim. The days do grow shorter. The springtime's briefer. And death is inevitable. And from the beginning of time, when human beings had the kind of mind that let us reflect not simply on the instinctual issues of danger, but the idea of oncoming death. And it's interesting that the second hymn that we sang has some other words by Tagore talking about, "Now I turn to think of coming death." We know it's inevitable with our heads. William Saroyan, as he lay dying, said, "You know, I knew the death was inevitable, but I thought it would make an exception for me." I think most of us have kind of that sense to us at certain points of our life. But as soon as human beings could reflect upon our mortality, we had a very simple and plaintive question, and it was, why? How did we get here, and why must we die? It seems so unfair. Existence is so miraculous. Mind is so wonderful. Life, with its colors often so terrific, why does it have to end? And that created immediately theological problems. Because how could it be that there was a divine creator, and the divine creator somehow put us into these defective bodies that obsolesced after a while, that wore out, that didn't seem to have a warranty program to go with it, and that we couldn't really sue the manufacturer because that would be impious. And our ancient ancestors looked at that, and they came up with a variety of theories, most of which centered on, and I'm using the word advisedly and technically, well, it's your own damn fault. because you were born to be immortal, but then there was the fall. There was that transgression in the Garden of Eden where God said to you, you can live forever. You can live in the garden forever. You can enjoy yourself forever. And you don't have to worry about whether Nordstrom is open because you don't need clothes. You don't have to worry about whether to get organic or non-organic because it's all good. Just stay away from the apples. Who knew? I thought apples were a good, nutritious snack, but I apparently was wrong about that. But through that act of disobedience, people became alienated and then had to work by the sweat of their brow and had to deal with mortality. Well, of course, that's also a metaphor. It's a metaphor at one level for youth, that all of us are born kind of naked and are taken care of, and we're not really in touch with our mortality. And as we get older, we become aware of our nakedness, of our needs, of our responsibilities. We, in a sense, trade our illusion of immortality for wisdom and for the power to make choices. But that's a very sophisticated doctrine. Our ancient ancestors of almost every religion came to the conclusion that, you know, God is perfect, and Eden was really nice, and we really messed it up, but ultimately the problem is this. God created a perfect world and an eternal spirit, and it's not here. It's somewhere else. On Thursday, I went to see the Dead Sea Scrolls down in San Diego, and I'm going to be teaching a class at the university on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'll also do a class here in a couple of months on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And one of the really interesting parts of it is that usually Christianity gets saddled with the idea, they came up with the idea of original sin and the alienation of God and sinner. But the truth is that almost every folklore and every religion has the idea that somehow we became estranged from something eternal. And almost every religion has the idea that, you know, we're not going to build paradise here. The world is just never going to be perfect because we're human beings and we're very difficult to get along with and we're really prickly. And we're never going to make it perfect because we get old. We wear out. Things get old. We can fix things, but eventually they fall out of warranty. And all of material existence is badly flawed. And then our ancient ancestors of every religion had to say, what was God thinking? Why didn't God do a better job on this? Why didn't God just make a perfect world? And their answer was, because they had a dog in the fight, dog, of course, being the dyslexic God, they had a dog in the fight. I'll wait a minute while you do the alphabet on that. D-O-G-G-O-D. They had a dog in the fight. I had to defend God by saying God's creation was perfect and it was eternal. But somehow material existence came into being as an unwanted side effect of the divine creation. That you had in Greek philosophy and religion, the Platonic ideals, and our world is but a dim shadow of that. In the Essenes, in the pre-Christian Judaism, you had the idea that this world needed to come to an end in order for there to be a perfect and eternal world, because we were filled with dirt and corruption. And that's why they built Qumran, they had 10 different mikvot, ritual baths. Ritual baths that they would go into before going to the bathroom, after going to the bathroom, before eating, after eating, before making love, after making love. They had the great OCD of washing all the sin off of them because they associated the material with the sinful. So this bifurcation between pure spirit, pure eternal spirit, and corrupt material existence has existed in virtually every religion, and it really is one of the systems for trying to explain that plaintive question of why must we die? Well, as Tom Robbins points out, mortality is a problem, but immortality isn't really much better. The first amoeba is still alive, or there wouldn't be an amoeba because it's just been dividing. And even if you kill one of them, the first amoeba is still meaningfully alive. We have traded immortality for individuality, for the potential of wisdom. We have traded naivete and childhood in Eden, not because of sin, but we have traded it in order to have wisdom and responsibility and power to make a difference. And one of the great gifts of mortality is this: it gets our attention. I was working this weekend, earlier this weekend, very nicely at the Eisman Sterling House, doing some writing and preparing this sermon. And as I was, I noticed the sun setting over the Pacific Ocean. I don't know how many sunrises and sunsets any of us has. So I closed the computer. I turned around. I went out onto the porch. I took a Guinness with me, and I sat there very nicely and enjoyed the changing of the colors and of the sky and the beauty of the sunset, because tomorrow's sunset is not guaranteed. That's one of the gifts of mortality. It gets us out of our lethargy from time to time, if we choose. It gets us out of our pains and our complaints from time to time, if we choose, and onto the porch, onto the dance floor, onto the celebration, and onto the party that is life. Final image. In Judaism, in Islam, in Christianity, there is a strain called Gnosticism. And that Gnosticism, whatever else those their beliefs are, there are beliefs that have to do with how this really is a side effect, how material existence is of an iffy nature. But there's a wonderful creation story by an old mystic whose name was Isaac Luria. And this is not to be taken literally, but poetically. We get into big trouble when we take it literally. But poetically, it said, in the beginning, God was pure light. But around the edges of that light, it got a little impure. It fell into material existence. And it fell into material existence in the form of jars. And God, being God, sensing that there were some impurities at the edge of existence, sent out pure rays from God's own center into the jars, but the jars couldn't hold it. And they shattered into a billion shards. And those billion shards are the atoms, are the molecules, are the trees, are the rivers, are the walls, the air, the seas, and ourselves. Every bit of creation has a divine spark in it and is to be treasured and honored. And there's something more that comes from this story. It is the idea that we don't simply sit around and wait for redemption, wait for God to somehow gather the shards together, but that we recognize the divinity, the holiness, the sacredness in every person, in every piece of creation, living and not living, and that we fan those sparks into flames, and that it is our job to redeem divinity, not to wait for divinity to redeem us. We don't know what other dimensions of life or afterlife there are, but we know the sun is shining today. We know that we had the strength to get up this morning, to wash, to come to church, to be together. We know that the day is beautiful and precious, and that we should be able to find wisdom and wonder in every moment. Now, notice the language was precise. We should be able to find wisdom and wonder in every moment. We won't, because we are human and we are distractible and we get off on sidetracks. But there is wisdom and wonder in every moment, in every person, in every season of spring, of summer, of fall, and of winter. And we celebrate all of those seasons in ourselves all of the time. And we have access to renewing those seasons within ourselves so long as we have breath.